Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
I think that all of the things that we've been working on for so long, that they have to come to the fore now because they were just kind of common sense that was just very hard to override the ideology, you know, of neoliberalism and, you know, all of the kind of the growth fetishists. And suddenly we need to base our economics back in reality, you know, Main Street and the real world. And I've been watching the debate going on in the Senate now on this $2 trillion bill. Right. And it's just amazing. You know, there's still half a billion in there to bail out hotels and airlines and cruise lines, for God's sake.
What a concept. Basing our economics on the real world. That's futurist and economic icon Hazel Henderson, our guest today on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Hi, I'm Walt McCree, Ellen's co-host and senior advisor to the Public Banking Institute. Hazel Henderson is perhaps best known for her work in creating a whole new category of thoughtful, real-world economic study that integrates multiple dimensions of life, such as the environment, quality of life, politics, social impact, and so forth. And as an author and lecturer, has examined how our definitions of reality are often shaped by those who are paid to focus on just select aspects of it, while shutting out the interplay of other dimensions that are equally or even more impactful. Hazel believes that the various threats to peace, community, security, and good environment have led us into a new era in which we're obliged to look for values, information, and know-how that we have seemed to be able to do without until recent decades. Hazel is the founder of Ethical Markets Media and author of Ethical Markets, Growing the Green Economy, and we're proud to have her as a member of the Public Banking Institute's advisory board. We'll talk with Hazel Henderson a bit later. But it's been a dramatic couple of weeks in our money and financial system, so let's talk to Ellen about it.
The past couple of weeks have been pretty dramatic, not just in terms of the market, but economies around the world have not only collapsed in the face of a perceived global pandemic, but also major discoveries have occurred of the most obvious kind, including that the Federal Reserve really has a bottomless cash drawer that it could be used for our benefit, but they seem to want to be using it for somebody else's benefit. Bring us up to speed on what's happened this week with this coronavirus business.
Okay, well, in the last month, the stock market dropped by a third, and that was right after the World Health Organization announced that the coronavirus was a global pandemic, which some people have questioned. But anyway, that was the trigger, and then the stock market went down, and of course, to Congress and to the president and the administration, I mean, that it's the stock market that is supposedly the measure of the economy. So they jumped in with the Federal Reserve jumped in with all its things that it did after the 2008 crisis. And the effect was to make the market drop even further because that just freaked the investors out like, oh, my God, it must be really bad. So the only thing that actually had an effect was when Trump said that they would be doing, or he was recommending, $50 billion that would be basically for the states for coronavirus, the things that they would have to do for that. And that did make the market go up for a bit, but then it dropped again. And so now, as of last weekend, supposedly it was supposed to be last Friday that Congress or that the Senate would come out with their proposal, but they only got it done at midnight Tuesday night, so last night. And the proposal includes $1.65 trillion in bailout money. I mean, it's a huge sum. And of that, we were hoping for a universal basic income. Tulsi Gabbard had recommended that, and Andrew Yang recommended it. And it sounded like they were talking about such a thing. But in fact, in this whole bill of $1.65 trillion, they're only giving $1,200 one-time payment for individuals, and or $2,400 if you're a two-person working family, plus $500 for a child. And that's only a one-time payment, and it's only if up to $75,000 income, which, I mean, that's all right. But anyway, it's a very small part of this giant check that they're planning to write that will go to individuals and families and workers. And then there's also some money for unemployment and stuff. But most of it is going to businesses, including small businesses, so that part is good. But it's mostly going to the big businesses. And then the real bailout is by the Federal Reserve. So they're firing up all these facilities that they had with the 2008 bailout, but they're taking more collateral. Like, they're taking virtually anything for collateral, trashy things that they in the original bailout, the problem was mortgage-backed securities. Well, now we have asset-backed securities, which are like car payments that people aren't paying on, et cetera. So you have all this collateral that's toxic, and the Fed is willing to take it, including they'll be bailing out the hedge funds. So they're bailing out everybody to the tune of $6.2 trillion. I mean, that's the size, the amount that they're willing to go. And the backstop for all that is that U.S. Treasury is going to be the backstop for all that. So the Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, has to approve it. But basically, the taxpayers are still going to be on the hook when the fund gets depleted. And the fund that goes back to 1933 with the money from the confiscated gold. Anyway, so we've got this $6 trillion bailout. So it's basically a blank check for the banks and the big investors and the hedge funds.
Corporations.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
So, well, the corporations is not quite a blank check. I mean, there are strings attached to that at least, but that's what Congress is doing. But what the Fed is doing is basically without strings. And unfortunately, that means all that leverage that we thought we were going to get out of this crisis, for example, where we could, like Thomas Hanna, who is on our Public Banking Institute Advisory Board, he's from Democracy Collaborative, he had a very good proposal that the next time we have to bail out the banks, that we'll say, you know, they need to become public utilities. They need to be regulated in a way that they're actually serving the public. But they've already done this backdoor bailout, so there will be no bankrupt banks. I mean, they won't appear to be bankrupt because they've got all these facilities they can now use from the Fed. And we don't really have leverage to say we want a universal basic income because they've done this one-time payment, and that's going to be the end of it.
So basically, they've slipped in a bailout in a backdoor kind of a way, kind of in the dead of night, so to speak, when everybody's at home, and when the people in Congress weren't able to shut it down, where the sessions were done remotely. This is David Dayen calls it a robbery in place. So to be really candid about it, we're being taken once again. By the banking and the financial interests to prop up a system that has failed us, and they're piddling little pittance of contribution to people who are working, staying at home without jobs, and all of that is just going to have to grin and bear it, guys. We've got corporations to save. That's kind of the nature of it, right?
Right, and these are the same people that were saying when Bernie and Elizabeth Warren and others were proposing things like universal basic income or Medicare for all. We can't afford it. Where are you going to get the money? It's going to be hyperinflationary. You can't use the Federal Reserve for that. But when their big corporations and the big banks and the big investors are on the line, then all of a sudden they can come up with $8 trillion.
Yeah.
So it's obvious that we have the funds. It's just a matter of the political will. So somehow we've got to get the political will for the people instead of just for big business and big money.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Ellen. It's a grim moment in both in the effort that we're trying to democratize our money supply and also trying to reclaim some of the power for the people over our money. So it's an outrageous development, in my opinion, but one that we're going to follow and kind of analyze and dig into in coming weeks. So thanks very much. We've got a great conversation with Hazel Henderson to get to. So thanks, Ellen.
Okay, thank you.
Before we go to our interview with Hazel Henderson, I just want to read a little piece from David Dayan, the editor of the American Prospect, about his response to the bailout package that was just passed by Congress. David Dayan writes, 12 years ago, banks asked for a bailout after years of irresponsible, highly leveraged lending. The Treasury Department put out a three-page term sheet seeking money from Congress with no strings attached, even eliminating judicial review. The Democrats balked, called it a slush fund and worse, then agreed after a few mostly meaningless bits of oversight and some promises to help ordinary people. That $700 billion bailout was window dressing for the trillions that came from the Federal Reserve, but it kept Congress quiet, hooking them into the notion that they rescued the system. Well, 12 years later, virtually the same course of events is taking place. After just a couple of weeks of extreme social distancing measures, the Treasury Department asked for a large bailout, this time of the entire corporate sector. The bill, as written initially, would have made all bailout activities secret for 6 months. The Democrats balked, calling it a slush fund and worse, and then agreed to a few mostly meaningless bits of oversight and some promises to help ordinary people. In fact, they're the same bits of oversight from the 2008 TARP bailout, a five-member oversight panel and an inspector general for the program. Well, the enormity of the bailout is being underreported. It's really more like $6 trillion. It's not a $2 trillion bill, but a $6 trillion bill. And David Dayan goes on to say, this is a robbery in progress, and it's not a bailout for the coronavirus. It's a bailout for 12 years of corporate irresponsibility that made these companies so fragile that a few weeks of disruption would destroy them. The short-termism and lack of capital reserves funneled record profits into a bathtub of cash for investors. That's who's being made whole. Financiers and the small slice of the public that owns more than a trivial amount of stocks. In fact, they've already been made whole. Yesterday, Wall Street got the word that they'd be saved, and stocks and bonds went wild. BlackRock, the world's largest asset manager that owns a lot of the foreclosed mortgage homes, by the way, is running these bailout programs for the Fed and could explicitly profit if the Fed buys its bonds, which it probably will. This is a rubber stamp on an unequal system that has brought terrible hardship for the majority of America. The people get a $1,200 means-tested payment and a little wage insurance for 4 months. Corporations get a transformative amount of play money to sustain their system and wipe out the competition. Those remarks from David Dayan of the American Prospect and are quite on target. Keep your eyes watching the target of what goes on next with our money. And now let's turn to the conversation that Ellen and I had with Hazel Henderson, the author and founder of Ethical Markets, Growing the Green Economy, and an international lecturer, a thought leader and futurist about the impacts of economy in the real world.
You wrote this excellent piece called Pandemics, Lessons Looking Back from 2050, along with
Fritjof Capra. My buddy, I have co-authored stuff with Fritjof for 30 years.
we've been sort of intellectual companions, and he ended up doing a deep dive into the ecosystems with his last book, you know, The Systems View of Life, and all of that. And of course, I decided to do a deep dive into the human, more the human condition. And so it was great to reconnect with him on this piece, you know, because it's so clear now. I was just reading a piece by one of our advisors, Professor Walden Bellow, who has been a legislator in the Philippines for many years. And he was just pointing out, you know, with this whole Belt and Road thing that the Chinese have been doing, you know, the Chinese obviously have a huge opportunity here to kind of take over the whole globalization agenda. And he was saying, which is rather similar to what Fritjof and I were saying, that just the amount of incursions into environments that Belt and Road will require, they're talking about additional alien species which will be driven out of forest areas. 98 new amphibians, 177 reptiles, 391 birds, and 150 mammals will now be another threat to the humans, you know, due to the transmission of viruses. So the thing that's so interesting about the globalization model using, you know, neoclassical economic cash-only GDP kind of model has just left us all so incredibly vulnerable. You know, the whole just-in-time supply chains where we suddenly find that all of our face masks, hey, they come from China, you know, and all of our pharmaceuticals come from China.
Yeah, it's one of those emperor has no clothes moments, or
isn't it?
When tide is out, you can see who's swimming naked.
Yes, so, absolutely.
I mean, that was kind of the gist of your paper. You've been saying this all along, but nobody bought it. You know, everything seems to be going along fine. The stock market's doing great, and that's the politician's barometer of whether the economy's doing well. But underneath, there were all these deficiencies and weaknesses and things that didn't work. And now when we're in a crisis, we can see that they didn't work, and we absolutely have to change the system.
Yes.
But whether we will, I don't know, because like the Fed has stepped in and exercised all these powers without authorization, and they're bailing out the banks. So we can't say, well, you've got to make those big banks be public utilities now because you bailed them out, because it's already been done. You know, there's no leverage. They failed to use the leverage power that they could have used there. So anyway, so our big conundrum right now is how do we get this message out there, and how do we get some real change that's all for the better, instead of just, you know, sort of Band-Aids, and then in 2 months they'll say, okay, crisis is over, back to business as usual.
Yes, exactly. I think that all of the things that we've been working on for so long, that they have to come to the fore now, because they were just kind of common sense that was just very hard to override the ideology, you know, of neoliberalism and, you know, all of the kind of the growth fetishists. And suddenly that's really what we're putting up on our website now. All of the comments we're getting from our advisory board members, you know, from Hong Kong and Thailand and all over the place, you know, who've been saying all of these things for years and years, you know, that we need to base our economics back in reality, you know, Main Street and the real world. And I think that if we all work to push that, I mean, I've been watching the debate going on in the Senate now on this $2 trillion bill. And it's just amazing. You know, there's still $500 million in there to bail out hotels and airlines and cruise lines, for God's sake. with no strings attached, you know, not even. And actually, I was watching Elizabeth Warren. She was on Bloomberg talking about the whole business of buybacks, you know, and what she is proposing is if you're going to do any stuff bailing out big corporations, that there's just a whole lot of things have to be legally required of companies, not just, you know, hoping that they don't do buybacks, you know.
Right. And they've essentially bailed out the banks, though they don't call it a bailout. So, you know, we were always petitioning before that the next time this happens, we want to make sure that the banks are required to use their funds appropriately, et cetera.
Yes.
That they're actually public utilities. But that's been bypassed because it's a backdoor bailout. It's not obvious. You know, nobody voted on it. The Senate didn't vote on it, or the Congress didn't vote on it.
Yeah.
Fed just did it using their alleged emergency powers under Section 13.3, I think. But the one thing they bypassed or didn't do was helping the state and local governments, which they they've got another provision that makes that quite. They don't even have to go to the Treasury, you know, and get approval like under 13.3. So that's one thing we're pushing for.
Well, I think that some of the changes, for example, I take Wired magazine and normally throw most of it away, you know, because it was all of the fantasies of the Silicon Valley adolescent guys. And I just received my new edition of Wired, and I read every page on it. It's an entirely different 180 degrees. And they've just gone through every aspect of the real world and how to shift to a low carbon, a green economy, and how to dump fossil fuels. I couldn't believe it. So it is possible that this is going to turn around a lot of paradigms.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think we all hope for, you know, in the public banking area and so many areas. It will be quite obvious that there's no other way of getting from here to there.
It seems to me that we're seeing the imminence of that paradigm shift because people have been disenfranchised from the monetary hopes that they had once been raised on. The American dream et al. Kind of went away for most people. And now we're down to basic needs that are not only water and air, familial stability, education, health, the kind of the human rights that FDR pointed out. People want some basic life support services from their governments.
Absolutely, yes. I mean,
as opposed to a monetary pursuit.
Yeah, I mean, that whole era of government bad, private sector good is so childish that I think everybody's realized now, you know, that of course the government has to step in. I mean, look at the situation right now where Trump has invoked the War Powers Act or whatever it's called, you know, and yet states are still forced to compete with each other to buy masks and gowns and gloves, you know, and Cuomo was saying in his press conference that it used to be under a dollar to buy a mask, but now he's competing with California and competing with Illinois, competing with private hospitals, and the price of a face mask now is up to $7. I mean, you can't imagine how stupid this is. I mean, if you don't nationalize procurement and prevent the price gouging, I mean, can you imagine that this administration doesn't even know how to prevent the price gouging? So it seems like this whole sort of small is beautiful idea that many of us had in the 1970s, you know, with community-owned wind generators and solar farms and farmers' markets and organic agriculture and all of that, just seems now just to make the most eminent sense, you know.
Yes, and changes the nature of markets. You know, from money to service.
Yes, exactly. I wrote a paper called Markets Problem Twins, Advertising and Trading, pointing out that both of those activities have been in excess. for quite a long time. And one of the problems now is we're still using the old ideology from the Cold War and the last century, you know, of communism versus capitalism, and we fought wars over it and everything like that. And the whole thing is that there's nothing wrong with markets. I mean, markets are in human DNA. We've been doing markets ever since we came out of trees. And markets evolve, and they're still evolving, and they're evolving now in the direction of the Green New Deal. So what's wrong with that, you know? And so how do we, here's a question for you, Walt. How do we dump all of these old ideologies, you know, the socialism, all stupid stuff?
Just say the mischaracterization of things like money as a commodity instead of a relationship. It's been adopted, of course, as a commodity that's at the base of our sense of market wisdom or market reality. But it's all about relationships. It's all about community.
Of course.
And getting back to that, as you say, Hazel, is, you know...
Yes. I mean, I've been tracking local currencies for the last 30 years, and I always use local currencies, of which there are hundreds of thousands all over the world, as an indicator of how badly whatever central bank in that particular country was doing. And any time, you know, the macroeconomic policymakers were screwing up, you could find local currencies and local credit unions and barter coming back.
I think things are a little different now, though, because you have these giant cities where people just don't have anything to trade. I mean, if we don't have land where we can grow our own food and trade it with others, so we do need the government system, and that's why we've got to lean on them to make some changes that serve the people in the local economy.
Of course, money is, as we all know, it's just credit, and so it is limitless, and that's really what I think where the certainly exciting, maybe even breathtaking aspects of this week as the Fed says, we'll cover everything. You got a debt, we'll cover it.
I know.
That kind of thing.
Oh,
well,
yeah.
This is a perfect setup for public banking.
Yes, and for UBI. Did you hear Neil Kashkari, who is the Fed head in Minneapolis? And he was on Bloomberg, and he just came right out and said it. Yes, he says the Fed prints money, and of course we can print all the money that is needed, and we'll keep shoving it out there. And he was going on like that on television, you know?
Yeah.
So it's all out in the open now. There's never been any shortage of money. I mean, money is just a string of digits on the computer.
Credit, and there's as much credit as you want. I mean, it's money is only an advance against a future promise to repay a debt, which means credit, which means I'll pay it later, and I'll pay a little interest to get, you know, to have to pay it later. Or we don't need, like, collateral, et cetera. You don't need to borrow the money from them.
And we can take those middlemen. You know, we can take all the bond dealers out of the game. And why do we have these middlemen, you know, that they're not needed anymore? I mean, basically, the whole idea of having Treasury and the Fed, you know, work more closely together, I think that that's coming.
So yeah, they're doing it right now.
So the crisis is exposed. The real problem, which is who controls the spigot of who can get the credit, and that, of course, is the financiers, the rentier society that has been determining public policy and our future and our current well-being. And again, it comes back to the franchise of banking being in the public interest opposed to in private hands.
Absolutely. I think that all of the things that we've been working on for so long, that they have to come to the fore now because they were just kind of common sense that was just very hard to override the ideology, you know, of neoliberalism and, you know, all of the kind of the growth fetishists. And suddenly that's really what we're putting up on our website now. All of the comments we're getting from our advisory board members, you know, from Hong Kong and Thailand and all over the place, you know, who've been saying all of these things for years and years, you know, that we need to base our economics back in reality, you know, in Main Street and the real world. And I think that if we all work to push that, I mean, I've been watching the debate going on in the Senate now on this $2 trillion bill. And it's just amazing. You know, there's still $500 million in there to bail out hotels and airlines and cruise lines, for God's sake, with no strings attached, you know, not even. And actually, I was watching Elizabeth Warren, who's my favorite candidate who I voted for. I mean, she was on Bloomberg and talking about the whole business of buybacks, you know, and what she is proposing is, if you're going to do any stuff bailing out big corporations, that there's just a whole lot of things have to be legally required of companies, not just, you know, hoping that they don't do buybacks, you know.
Right. And they've essentially bailed out the banks, though they don't call it a bailout. So, you know, we were always petitioning before that the next time this happens, we want to make sure that the banks are required to use their funds appropriately, et cetera.
Yes.
That they're actually public utilities. But that's been bypassed because it's a backdoor bailout. It's not obvious. You know, nobody voted on it. The Senate didn't vote on it, or the Congress didn't vote on it.
Yeah.
Fed just did it using their alleged emergency powers under Section 13.3, I think. But the one thing they bypassed or didn't do was helping the state and local governments, which they they've got another provision that makes that quite. They don't even have to go to the Treasury, you know, and get approval like under 13.3. So that's one thing we're pushing for. You wrote this excellent piece called Pandemics, Lessons Looking Back from 2050, along with
Fritjof Capra. My buddy, I have co-authored stuff with Fritjof for 30 years. We've been sort of intellectual companions, and he ended up doing a deep dive into the ecosystems with his last book, you know, The Systems View of Life, and all of that. And of course, I decided to do a deep dive into the human condition. And so it was great to reconnect with him on this piece, you know, because it's so clear now. I was just reading a piece by one of our advisors, Professor Walden Bellow, who has been a legislator in the Philippines for many years. And he was just pointing out, you know, with this whole Belt and Road thing that the Chinese have been doing, you know, the Chinese obviously have a huge opportunity here to kind of take over the whole globalization agenda. And he was saying, which is rather similar to what Fritjof and I were saying, that just the amount of incursions into environments that Belt and Road will require, they're talking about additional alien species which will be driven out of forest areas. 98 new amphibians, 177 reptiles, 391 birds, and 150 mammals will now be another threat to the humans, you know, due to the transmission of viruses. So the thing that's so interesting about the globalization model using, you know, neoclassical economic cash-only GDP kind of model has just left us all so incredibly vulnerable. You know, the whole just-in-time supply chains where we suddenly find that all of our face masks, hey, they come from China, you know, and all of our pharmaceuticals come from China.
Yeah, it's one of those emperor has no clothes moments, or
isn't it?
When tide is out, you can see who's swimming naked.
Yes, so, absolutely.
I mean, that was kind of the gist of your paper, saying this all along, but nobody bought it. You know, everything seems to be going along fine. The stock market's doing great, and that's the politician's barometer of whether the economy's doing well. But underneath, there were all these deficiencies and weaknesses and things yes. that didn't work. And now when we're in a crisis, we can see that they didn't work, and we absolutely have to change the system.
Yes.
But whether we will, I don't know, because like the Fed has stepped in and exercised all these powers without authorization, and they're bailing out the banks. So we can't say, well, you've got to make those big banks be public utilities now because you bailed them out, because it's already been done. You know, there's no leverage. They failed to use the leverage power that they could have used there. So anyway, so our big conundrum right now is how do we get this message out there, and how do we get some real change that's all for the better, instead of just, sort of Band-Aids, and then in 2 months they'll say, okay, crisis is over, back to business as usual.
Yes, exactly. Well, I think that some of the changes, now, for example, I take Wired magazine and normally throw most of it away, you know, because it was all of the fantasies of the Silicon Valley adolescent guys. And I just received my new edition of Wired, and I read every page on it. It's an entirely different 180 degrees, and they've just gone through every aspect of the real world and how to shift to a low carbon, a green economy, and how to dump fossil fuels. I couldn't believe it. So it is possible that this is going to turn around a lot of paradigms.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think we all hope for, you know, in the public banking area and so many areas. It will be quite obvious that there's no other way of getting from here to there.
It seems to me that we're seeing the imminence of that paradigm shift, because people have been disenfranchised from the monetary hopes that they had once been raised on. The American dream et al. Kind of went away for most people. And now we're down to basic needs that are not only water and air, familial stability, education, health, the kind of the human rights that FDR pointed out. And the Chinese Belt and Road model seems to be doing what American foreign policy has failed to do, and that is to provide really needed public services. People want some basic life support services from their governments.
Absolutely, yes. I mean,
as opposed to a monetary pursuit.
Yeah, I mean, that whole era of government bad, private sector good is so childish that I think everybody's realized now, you know, that of course the government has to step in. I mean, look at the situation right now where we've Trump has invoked the War Powers Act or whatever it's called, you know, and yet states are still forced to compete with each other to buy masks and gowns and gloves, you know, and Cuomo was saying in his press conference that it used to be under a dollar to buy a mask, but now he's competing with California and competing with Illinois, competing with private hospitals, and the price of a face mask now is up to $7. I mean, you can't imagine how stupid this is. I mean, if you don't nationalize procurement and prevent the price gouging, I mean, can you imagine that this administration doesn't even know how to prevent the price gouging? So, I mean, it seems like, you know, what Fritjof Capra and I were just saying is that, you know, this whole sort of small is beautiful idea that many of us had in the 1970s, you know, with community-owned wind generators and solar farms and farmers markets and organic agriculture and all of that, just seems now just to make the most eminent sense, you know.
Yes. And changes the nature of markets, you know, from money to service.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, one of the things that I wrote a paper called Markets Problem Twins, Advertising and Trading, pointing out that both of those activities have been in excess for quite a long time. And that one of the problems now is we're still using the old ideology from the Cold War and the last century, you know, of communism versus capitalism, and we fought wars over it and everything like that. And the whole thing is that there's nothing wrong with markets. I mean, markets are in human DNA. We've been doing markets ever since we came out of trees. And markets evolve, and they're still evolving, and they're evolving now in the direction of the Green New Deal. So what's wrong with that, you know? And so how do we, here's a question for you, Walt. How do we dump all of these old ideologies, you know, the socialism, all stupid stuff?
Just say the mischaracterization of things like money as a commodity instead of a relationship. It's been adopted, of course, as a commodity that's at the base of our sense of market wisdom or market reality. But it's all about relationships. It's all about community.
Of course.
And getting back to that, as you say, Hazel, is,
Yes. I mean, I've been tracking local currencies for the last 30 years, and I always use local currencies, of which there are hundreds of thousands all over the world, as an indicator of how badly whatever central bank in that particular country was doing. And any time, you know, the macroeconomic policymakers were screwing up, you could find local currencies and local credit unions and barter coming back. And, you know, one of the most valuable books in our 9,000-volume library here, it's the library about what's wrong with conventional economics and the green economy library. And basically this book came out, and it's called Depression Scrip. I don't know if you've seen this book, but it's about 400 pages of pictures of local currencies that were in our transmission in the 1930s after the bank holidays. And most of them were like tax anticipation notes of local fisks, or they were unemployed workers, promissory notes. And I used to always, whenever I was going out giving a lecture someplace, I would always take a page out of this catalog to, you know, representing the local currencies in the area that I was going to be speaking. And I would throw it up, you know, on an overhead, and always somebody in the audience says, "Oh, I remember my dad had some of those in his closet, in his drawer." And, you know, that was one of the reasons we got through the Depression.
Right. I think things are a little different now, though, because you have these giant cities where people just don't have anything to trade. I mean, if we don't have land where we can grow our own food and trade it with others. So we do need the government system, and that's why we've got to lean on them to make some changes that serve the people in the local economy.
What the Fed did, you know, and how we sort of have to shift, you know, to radically new ideas on the fiscal side.
Right.
You know.
That was another article that was basically the emperor has no clothes, that they've all along they've said, no, we can't do this, we can't do that. You know, you can't do a universal basic income because it'll be inflationary. Where are you going to get the money, all that stuff. When we have a crisis, all of a sudden, where to get the money is absolutely no problem. It's like in wartime. They always manage to come up with the money in wartime. But also, this is war against a virus, I guess. So
sure.
It shows that the money's there. So
of course.
For a UBI or whatever else.
Yes. Well, you know, Andrew Yang, I'm glad that he's now a pundit on MSNBC. So we hear Andrew Yang now and his UBI proposals all the time. He's probably realized it's far better to be a pundit on the television than it is to run for president.
We were fortunate to have him as a guest on this program.
Oh, good.
before he announced his candidacy. And of course, it was the UBI thread, which comes out of the notion that money is always available. Of course, money is, as we all know, it's just credit, and so it is limitless. And that's really what I think were the certainly exciting, maybe even breathtaking aspects of this week as the Fed.
Oh yeah,
we'll cover everything. You got a debt, we'll cover it.
I know.
That kind of thing.
Oh,
well,
yeah.
Well, this is a perfect setup for public banking.
Definitely. Yes, and for UBI. I mean, did you hear Neel Kashkari, who is the Fed head in Minneapolis? And he was on yesterday on Bloomberg, and he just came right out and said it. Yes, he says the Fed prints money, and of course we can print all the money that is needed, and we'll keep shoving it out there. And he was going on like that on television, you know.
Yeah.
So it's all out in the open now. Mm-hmm. There's never been a shortage of money. I mean, money is just a string of digits on
right.
a computer.
It's credit, and there's as much credit as you want. I mean, it's money is only an advance against a future promise to repay. It's
yes.
all debt, which means credit, which means I'll pay it later, and I'll pay a little interest to get, you know, to have
yes.
the time to pay it later. So we don't need banks, or we don't need like collateral, et cetera. You don't need to borrow the money from somewhere
no.
else.
And we can take those middlemen. You know, we can take all the bond dealers out of the game. And why do we have these middlemen? You know, they're not needed anymore. I mean, basically, the whole idea of having Treasury and the Fed, you know, work more closely together, you know,
mm-hmm.
I think that that's coming.
Yeah, no, Well, they're doing it right now.
So the crisis is exposed. The real problem, which is the middleman, or is, you know, who controls the spigot of who says
yes.
who can get the credit. And that, of course, is we call it the oligarchy, I suppose, may as well, the plutocracy, the people who are the money, the financiers, the rentier society that has been determining public policy and our future and our current well-being. And again, it comes back to the franchise of banking being in the public interest, opposed to in private hands.
Exactly. Absolutely. Yes. So I wanted to just finish the thought about the TV special that we uplinked ourselves here from Ethical Markets to the PBS network almost 10 years ago, called The Money Fix. And it was the politics of money creation and credit allocation. And we pointed out, you know, in very great detail how this was done and who made the decisions and how it was that, you know, quantitative easing printed the money. And the whole issue was who they gave it to. Did they give it to their friends, you know, in the banking system, hoping it would trickle down or whatever? And the other half was all about local, how nature's economy works and how local societies work and all of the amount of bartering and swapping that goes on when the banking system fails. And that we've had so much feedback from that show over the years, you know, and we uplinked it again and people say it changed their lives. And so one of the groups we've been working with recently is based in London called Positive Money. Do you know those folks?
Yeah, for sure.
I did a review on a Green Bank of England, and I just loved the fact, you know, we posted the news that when Christine Lagarde became president of the ECB about 2 months ago, they went right into her office and got her on videotape saying that she would take a look at the whole idea of green quantitative easing. So they are really on it. Now, here's what I wanted to throw out a question to you guys. And that regards the actual biology of the coronavirus. And what's going on today, you know, with the debate going on about is the priority the health of the population or is the priority the health of the economy, you know, that back and forth. And the whole thing about testing, now it seems to me that the key number we need to look at is 40%. And what I mean is that we should be testing also for antibodies. how many people, it's a fairly easy blood test, how many people have antibodies in their blood, meaning that they already had the coronavirus probably a month ago and didn't know it. And so you find out how many people in the population are now immune because they've already had it and they've got the antibodies. And those people are ready to restart the economy. And so it reminds me a lot of when I was growing up in Britain. And before there was any vaccines for mumps and measles. And the way things were done in Britain back then was every mother made sure that their children had measles and mumps before they were like 5 years old. And I know in the small town I grew up in, there were mumps and measles parties people made sure that the kids got the mumps and measles and got it over with. And as a result, you know, I am still 100% immune to those two diseases. Because I have the antibodies. So the point is that at some point, this idea of because we so screwed up on the testing that we've shut down the entire economy, including the idiocy here in Florida of shutting down the beaches where people need to go out and have exercise. And all you need to do is to have police on the beach to make sure that people don't, you know, congregate. Uh-huh. And this is what Andrew Cuomo said yesterday in his press briefing. He said we have to open all the parks again in New York State. People have to be allowed to go out and exercise.
Right, and we're going to make people sick.
Yeah, otherwise, well, not only are we going to prolong the people being sick, but people cooped up in apartments are going to go stir crazy and they'll
start
disobeying the rules anyway, you know?
Yeah. Or you'll see homicides and suicides.
Exactly. So there is a sense in which I think we have to get the biology right and realize that, you know, we are just like any other mammal species, and that we develop immunities to diseases, and that's kind of the normal process. And if we try to totally protect everybody from getting the disease, how do people get the immunity they need if we don't have a vaccine for another year and a half?
Well, that's an excellent point. I've got tons and tons of notes. I'd love to write on the whole medical part, but they won't let me because I have to write on public banking. But, you know, I did 10 books on health and alternative health care before I got into banking, but we're approaching this whole thing wrong. I agree.
That's very interesting, Ellen. I didn't realize that. You know, I've been trying to reach politicians here, you know, to say, for heaven's sakes, you know, what could be more stupid in Florida than not having the beaches open?
In Germany, you're not allowed to congregate more than two people.
That's absolutely ridiculous, because people can't live that way. And what will happen, it will just create civil disobedience. We've got 2,000 miles of beaches around this coastline. And the idea of closing those off when people desperately need to exercise, unbelievable.
When you talk about an uprising, we look at the economics of the current moment, and we see that people are pushed to the test. You know, there's an uprising, as our friend Swami Beyondananda, Steve Behrman, says, uprising about how things are ordered. Doesn't this suggest that this is a very rich time for us to push really as hard as possible against the prevailing private capital matrix that is here? How might we go about pushing public banking opportunity in this crisis at this moment?
I think it's just going to become more and more obvious to people when markets work and when they don't work. And I mean, right now, to try to do things the way we're doing them, we've seen the colossal market failure in this for-profit-based healthcare system, which I'm sure is uniting the thinking of Joe Biden with that of Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, you know, that it clearly doesn't work. I mean, I was lucky enough to grow up in Britain with the National Health Service. And, you know, for us, it wasn't about money and it wasn't about markets or profits. It was that healthcare was a right. And that if you didn't provide healthcare to everybody, then everybody was in danger. And we've now discovered in front of our very eyes that that's what's happening here. So I think there are analogies across the whole private sector type of thinking, you know, that markets work beautifully at the local level, you know, like the farmers market we have here every Saturday where I buy all my organic fruit and vegetables. I mean, markets work very well if they're really tied to the real economy and they're locally embedded. But the moment markets escape out into this, you know, high-frequency computerized trading on Wall Street, which I've been criticizing for years, where trading has actually become an addiction, like gambling, and the same thing with advertising. I mean, advertising was sort of introduced way back after World War II, the idea that we needed somehow to hype consumption, and we don't need it anymore, you know? So markets always go out of control once they leave the real economy. So, I mean, that's where public banking, you know, is so important because it keeps the whole thing the way it should be, which, as we all know, it should be simply a public utility.
I totally agree, but I've thought about that on advertising. I mean, it's so annoying. But it is, in a free market, it is your only way to get out there. Like even writing a book, you know, you've got to get it out there somehow so people know that it's there. And if you have a new product, how are people supposed to hear about it? So, I mean, it is kind of a fine line. We can't just ban advertising altogether, but you're right, it's gotten way, way...
It doesn't have to have tax credits and tax exemptions.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we've talked about money being a relationship. It's fundamentally a relationship between people, but people's own relationship to themselves around money, the sense of self-identification, which is reinforced by these advertising images and pursuits and desires, is part of the paradigm shift, I think, as we find ourselves moving away from a growth economy that has to have acquire more, that we can grow back together.
So going back to advertising for a minute, that's why I set up the advertising award for advertising that uplifts the human spirit in society. Most of the advertising campaigns that won our awards over the last 10 years, where they really are much more advertising in the public good, in the public interest, about community values and to shift advertising, which is, after all, the global education system that we have in default at the moment, which is mostly miseducation about unsustainable kinds of consumption.
Well, Hazel, thank you so much for joining us today and bringing us up to speed on the great work that you're doing. This is a time of transformative possibilities, and you certainly have opened that up for us for decades now with your reimagining markets, introducing the whole idea of having an ethical component for our exchange. So thank you for joining us on It's Our Money.
Oh, it's a great pleasure, Walt, and more power to our Public Banking Institute. Its time has come. Take care. All the best.
That's Hazel Henderson, author, lecturer, futurist, and founder of Ethical Markets. You can find her work at ethicalmarkets.com. Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.